The Off the Ball Podcast Network. The Paddy Power Half Hour on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.
You're very welcome into this Friday's edition of the Paddy Power Half Hour. Myself, Will O'Callaghan, and Endicall and Phil Egan as well. You will notice we're not in our suits as we were last week. We're back as casual as we could possibly be. But thank you for supporting Formal Friday last week across all the stations on Communicore. We raised over €160,000 for frontline health workers across the country. Gentlemen, first thing I'm going to say to you, good afternoon.
Hey, Will.
Back in the hoodies. Good to see you back nice and cash for this week, lads. We've got lots to talk about over the next half hour or so. And we'll perhaps start with France because of the situation there with the top flight league, where L'Equipe reporting this week that PSG will be crowned champions after the decision that no football will be played in France until the autumn. Similarly, they've lost the French top 14 in rugby as well. Enda, what's your take on this? PSG potentially now being crowned champions. They were well ahead, 12 points clear in a game in hand as well, but it looks like they won't have to finish it out to be crowned champions.
Yeah, I suppose it's unfortunate for the teams that are chasing them, but if you look at the record in France over the last couple of years, did anybody doubt whether PSG were going to wrap up the title at the end of the season? I don't think they did. So it's probably a smart decision from the French league to do this, if it is the French league that is making this decision. What is going to be interesting over the next couple of days and weeks as well is the ramifications across Europe, because there is now precedent for leagues to make a decision and decide how they want to finish it out, decide how they're going to choose the European spots. The relegation spots are probably the more important ones, but it'll be interesting to see now. With the likes of the I know the Belgium League was decided and Club Brugge were essentially made champions of that, and you'll see several leagues following suit in that way as well. So I would say it'll be interesting to see which bigger leagues follow the French League, because I know it's probably easier to call off the smaller leagues. It might not have the financial backing that the likes of the Bundesliga, the La Liga and the Premier League have. So I would say the bigger leagues have a bigger decision to make, a harder one to make than the smaller leagues across Europe.
Phil Egan, this is the first of kind of Europe's big five leagues which have made a very definitive decision. As Enda mentioned, we had the Eredivisie, the Belgian League have already made decisions on what they're going to do. They're not going to finish out their seasons. But this is the first of the big ones to make what is really a massive call.
Yeah, and when the announcement was made on Tuesday about the sporting events not happening even behind closed doors in France until September, it did set things going, and we kind of wondered what the implications and the knock-on effect would be around Europe. As you said, it is one of the bigger leagues. We know the Dutch league have pretty much said that they're done. Belgium are, I know they were the first ones to come out and say that they were going to cancel the season, but they haven't actually done that vote yet. They still have to meet next week. Now, they could do it. Obviously, the call from UEFA is that if you're not going to finish your season, if you can't do it, sporting merit should decide the places. Now, it's quite easy to give the championship to PSG, as you said, 12 points clear, game in hand, given their track record. This would be their third league win in a row, that they would go on and win the league. And the same applies in the Premier League. Liverpool are 25 points clear. Worst case scenario, they'd be 22 points clear if Manchester City won their game in hand. That's not the problem. Because I think we all knew even before football was suspended, Liverpool were going to win the Premier League. It's what happens the other places, the Champions League places, the relegation places in particular, given the difference between the Premier League and the Championship in terms of the revenue that you create. So if you're in the bottom three and you still have 9 or 10 games left and you're being told sporting merit decides, you're being relegated, that I know this is something we haven't experienced in football for a long time, but you could imagine the three clubs in the relegation zone would be thinking, that doesn't really sound like sporting merit to me. So given the amount of money at stake, that is why we're still having this conversation. Will the Premier League season be finished? Will La Liga be finished? Will the Bundesliga be finished? Serie A? If the Bundesliga is the first one to get underway, I would imagine the other leagues that I mentioned will all be looking closely to think, can it be done? And if so, how can we do it?
I get the feeling then that this could well end up in court. If you look at teams towards the bottom of the table, just taking a look at the French league at the moment, some teams have 11 games left, some have 10 games left. That's a lot of points to play for in a pretty tight relegation race. And if you were to be relegated based on what your points total was, with still 11 games potentially left in your season, I'd imagine you're fighting that legally all the way.
As a club, you are, definitely, for sure. And that's what we're just bracing ourselves for, is a ton of clubs just arguing against this. They don't want to be relegated, and that's fair enough. I mean, the season's not over, and that's where the complications come in. But you also have complications when it comes to players. Will they be in contract by the time that this rolls around, if they do finish out the season? And outside of the clubs, if you focus on the players for a second, there's a big difference between being a Premier League player and being a Championship player. I've heard several former players who went from the Championship to the Premier League speak about the difference in not only the quality of player, but just the size of your pay packet. And that they knew that their lives would never be the same once they became a Premier League player, because they knew they would be set up after football, if they weren't silly with their money, that they would be set up and their family would be set up for basically the rest of their lives. Whereas a Championship player might have to start considering whether they want to go into coaching, whether they want to go into punditry, or whether they have to find a job after football. I know they're still paid pretty well, but we're still talking about 30, 40 years post-retirement. So at a local level, it's a big deal for a Premier League player to get relegated. So it's going to hit them the hardest. It will hit the clubs, no doubt about it, but at the end of the day, it's the players that get onto the pitch. That's why the sport exists. That's why they get paid. So I think the impact of the players is going to be something that's going to be interesting coming forward, because even Pat Nevin pointed out on the football show on Wednesday night that some of the players might not want to play. Some of the players might point blank refuse to play in any competition that goes ahead in the middle of a global pandemic. And he spoke about when they went to pre-season in the likes of China, when they went to previously war-torn countries in Eastern Europe, that some players blank refused to go there because they didn't feel safe doing it. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see that going forward as well.
Well, just in terms of the football, Sean, of course, our football coverage here on Off the Ball is with thanks to Paddy Power. Here's Philippe Clare speaking to Joe Malloy earlier this week about why leagues might come back at different stages, and also why some countries might be better prepared for the leagues to return than others.
It's estimated that if you take the example of England, of the Premier League, should the competition stop now and not be resumed, I think the Premier League clubs would lose something about 1.3 billion. That's been estimated, the estimation where you put together sponsorship money, TV money, and ticketing money. In France, which is not a league which is as rich, obviously, as a Premier League, it's estimated to be about 760 million euros. That's a huge amount of money. And French football simply doesn't have the means to cope with that, as perhaps the Premier League does. So you can imagine that quite a few club chairmen are a little bit worried about what's going to happen to them. But there are also people who are saying, and I was talking yesterday with Ligue 2, which is, you know, second division, a chairman of a club which, to be honest, it won't make much difference whether the season stops now or carries on in some fashion later in the summer. But he was saying, you know, one thing that many of the people within football agreed was that there was something quite weird and perhaps even immoral about football being completely forgotten as a participation sport. Like, nobody can play in the parks, nobody can play in the lower divisions, in the amateur divisions, when it would actually be safer to play in front of 20 people than in front of 2,000 or 20,000. And why is it that elite football should be treated differently? You know, shouldn't football start from the bottom up, which is, by the way, I believe what the World Health Organization, one of their experts, has been saying today. So at the moment, we're in a state of flux, and we were hoping that there would be some kind of clarity, as has been the case, for example, in the Netherlands or in Mauritius, which was the first country to actually put a stop to the season. Belgium, we still don't quite know, apart from the fact that Cercle Brugge is champions, but there are still quite a few things to be loose ends to be tied. And in France, there are still quite a lot of things which need to be decided, apart from the fact that we're not going to play until 1st of September. That much is clear. Okay. Which is perhaps the one thing that should attract the most attention elsewhere. When you hear the plans in Spain, when you hear about the plans which are less firm in Italy, when you hear about the Germans, I mean, Christian Seifert and of the Bundesliga has been saying, which sounds to be completely insane, as it's starting again from 9th of May, it's not going to happen. So it's perhaps the French attitude has more is more interesting in terms of what it says about the current state, the sanitary state basically that we are in at the moment, which means that resuming this type of competition even behind closed doors is impossible until the 1st of September. It's a message that is, you know, very, very strong, and you wonder how it's been taken on by the other four big European leagues.
Phil Egan, we're just listening to Philippe Auclair there speaking to Joe earlier this week on the football show on Off the Ball, and I think a very reasonable point made there that, you know, it's very clear why Germany is able to look at bringing the Bundesliga back next month or towards the end of this month, because Germany has had a very different experience with COVID-19 than the rest of Europe. So perhaps we shouldn't be totally surprised that maybe some countries are better prepared for the return to football than elsewhere.
Yeah, and you know, it's no surprise that Germany are one of the countries that can do this. But I think even just going back to the general conversation about wrapping up all these leagues, what we haven't talked about is, it's all well and good cancelling these leagues. There seems to be this rush that the leagues have to be cancelled because then we can start looking at next season. But, you know, if you're cancelling the current seasons because we want to get ready for next season, the fact that we've had to cancel this season would suggest that we're not ready to resume football. So, you know, most seasons restart in August, September. If that can't happen, then you're looking at having to make changes to next season. And that's kind of been my thinking the whole time, is if you have to make changes to a season that hasn't happened, why not just finish this season when it's actually safe to do so, whether that's in September or even if you have to wait until next year to do it. Just, Enda mentioned something about players going from Premier League to Championship. Also, think about all the clauses they have. They have relegation clauses, some of these clubs that are down at the bottom. They would have signed players that basically said, look, if we get relegated, you've got a clause that you can be sold. So there's so much at stake that you just seem to be in this mad rush to get seasons declared, whether they're going to happen, whether they don't happen, whether we cancel them, as if then as soon as that's done, right, let's all sit back now and we can start planning for next season. That can't happen either.
It's a very interesting point as well, Phil, about the date of possible resumption. There is no guarantee whatsoever. It seems the 1st of September has now become the magic date. It used to be the 1st of June that actually sport would be allowed to return when we look at social distancing and when we look at maybe how this virus will have evolved by then. Even when you see, like, the Japanese minister saying this week that without a vaccine, it could be difficult to even host the Tokyo Olympics next summer. We may well have to be braced to wait that bit longer for organised sport to return. I mean, I know everything's being looked at in terms of scenario planning, but there's absolutely no guarantee that football actually gets back underway.
And even if it does get back underway, and what happens if a player tests positive for coronavirus while it's back underway, that'll just obviously set the whole thing back. But more importantly, it will show that it happened too soon, because the player safety has to be the first top of the list. And you can understand why some players would say, I don't really feel that comfortable going in to play. And there's all sorts of contingencies. Obviously, the Premier League are meeting today, and I'm sure we'll hear more this afternoon on what comes out of the meeting. But yeah, it's because all the different leagues are at different stages in terms of where the virus is, what stage it's at in the various different countries. It's just so hard to have a universal football calendar at the moment, or a European calendar.
And Spain's an interesting example here, because Javier Tebas, their president, was speaking this week. He says they're all systems go to get things back going behind closed doors in June. He accepts there probably won't be fans in the stadiums until at least 2021, but he's already looking at widespread testing of players by the end of this week by medical staff. It seems to me they're determined to get La Liga back going. The thing that was interesting, though, is he was using the economic argument as opposed to a sporting integrity argument as to why they need to finish the season.
Yeah, I was going to mention that the way that he's speaking is as if that football is an essential service and people need it and require it. And so some of the industry will suffer because of the lack of football. And that is true to an extent. But what he's not taking into account is that for football to work as a service or as a company, you need people around it. You need services that would require people to go into jobs that wouldn't necessarily be essential. You have to take into account camera crews, TV crews, radio operators, commentators. Then you have the essential services, the strain you would be put on, and then with having medical staff around the stadium at the time. Then you have the issues, and Philippe Auclair also mentioned this, of policing. How do you police these games? How do you stop people in areas close to the stadiums from trying to get towards the stadium, closer to the action, like we saw with PSG in the Champions League when Paris, the game was behind closed doors, but all the PSG fans turned up outside the stadium anyway. How do you police that? You need policing to do that. So therefore, you're taking that police away from other areas that might not be, you're taking them away from being lockdown control, essentially. So football would be a massive strain on that industry. And for... I don't think football is that important. I think it is a service, it is an industry that is suffering, but every industry is suffering. And that doesn't give every industry the right to put serious strain on very important services around the country. So I think he's completely way off with his estimation of where football stands in society.
All right, let's switch over then to another thing that's been in the news this week, and that's Newcastle's potential takeover. It's an if rather than a when in terms of the Saudis taking over at Newcastle. But plenty of debate, Phil, about who's going to be in charge if that's to happen. It would seem Steve Bruce will not be the manager if they were to come in and start splashing the cash. Two names very heavily linked at the moment. Rafa Benitez, understandably, given that he's now available again to potentially go back into Newcastle and maybe finish what he started in terms of his first job there. And also, interestingly, Mauricio Pochettino is being linked with the position as well. He said he's looking for a new project, very much ready to get back into management now. I'm sure Spurs would be delighted not to be paying him gardening leave if he was to take up a job. Phil, if it was your choice and you were Newcastle's owners coming in, would you appoint Rafa or would you appoint Poch?
Yeah, it's a tough one because obviously Rafa did a great job with limited resources. When I say limited resources, I mean in compared to other jobs that he's had, you know, this is a guy that has won the Champions League before. He's won domestic titles in other countries. Like, he's a top quality coach, top quality manager. But, you know, he was doing things with limited resources, as in Mike Ashley wouldn't always give him the cash. Now, at certain times, he would almost to make a statement where Rafa Benitez was looking for something. I think back to January, would have been 2018, was it, when Almiron was signed, and you know, at the time that was a lot of money. But I always felt with Benitez, it was never going to, like, he pretty much hit the ceiling in terms of where he could take Newcastle when Mike Ashley was there. So that's the intrigue. If you're a Newcastle fan, what could Rafa do if he was given a bit more money and more resources where he could bring in better players? Because he had some fairly limited players. He was criticised at times for the way he approached games against bigger clubs. I think back to a game against Manchester City where he pretty much just conceded possession for the whole game. But don't forget, the following season, they actually beat Manchester City at St. James's Park. So Rafa Benitez was pragmatic, whereas Pochettino obviously took Spurs to different levels, never got over the line, didn't get that silverware. Newcastle would be looking for silverware. If the Saudis come in, they'd be looking to invest heavily. There is talk that the financial fair play rules are going to be loosened a bit, which would obviously suit Newcastle. I don't know what other clubs would think about that, but it would mean Pochettino would be given a lot of money, and maybe he'd be given more money that he could show, actually, do you know what? The only thing that was holding me back when I was at Spurs to get to the next level was I just couldn't put the final piece of the jigsaw together because I just didn't have the funds. And we've kind of seen what's happened since he's left Spurs and towards the tail end of his tenure at Spurs, that the lack of investment, and now look at Spurs, they're kind of faded away from a team that the peak was challenging for Premier League titles, and the last kick in them was to get to the Champions League final last season.
Intriguing end of this, you know, potentially which way you would go if Rafa and Poch are both interested in the position, because you go for Rafa Benitez, you bring back a guy who had a great connection with the fans, who they really loved, a guy who knows the club, you'd imagine would be ready to hit the ground running. But Pochettino being there potentially in the background is someone that you could appoint. You could get really sexy football, you get a guy who's got to a Champions League final very recently, and you've got a guy who's been in a title race and is maybe ready to bring a team just over the hill and get them the success. Which way would you be going?
I think it's a bit too early for Pochettino at Newcastle. I think the example you'd use is the most recent takeover like this at Man City, and they didn't jump in straight away for the high-profile manager that would build the club up from the ground up. They slowly invested the money at first because obviously you had financial fair play, but they also knew they couldn't just throw money and hope that it would stick. They had to build something long-term and sustainable. Whether the Newcastle owners, should that deal go through, will consider that approach. I mean, Man City have built a global, the Man City owners have built a global base of clubs all around the world, so they have a sustainable business plan as well as that. So they had Mark Hughes, and he built a small amount over a couple of years, but he invested quite poorly at times. Rocky Santa Cruz springs to mind as one player they brought in with all the cash that they had at the start. So you want a manager who knows how to invest money smartly. Rafa Benitez would be your go-to man for that because he had to work on tight shoestrings to begin with at Newcastle. So I think at the time when he was in charge, I would have been really interested to see what he did had he had the money, had he had the investment. So I would personally like to see Rafa just to see what he would do now, to see if actually he's evolved as a manager since the Rafa Benitez who has success with Valencia and had success with Liverpool, to see if he still has that in him, because I think a lot of people do doubt whether that manager is still there, whether he's still a manager that could build a club to actually have success. And Pochettino's obviously the sexy name, but there's no guarantee he's going to work out. He could be a manager that, you know, he goes to Newcastle and it just doesn't work. He has all this money. He just can't invest it properly. So I would personally like to see Rafa Benitez get it.
And Phil, just before we move away from Newcastle, it's kind of a strange situation for their fans, and anyone who wants to read about the potential ethical complications about being owned by this Saudi Arabian group, you just probably read friend of the show Miguel Delaney over the last couple of weeks, who's been doing some really interesting work on it. But if you're a Newcastle fan, it's probably tricky. You've had Mike Ashley, who chances are you haven't liked over the last while. You're starved for success, you're starved for some investment in the club, the potential for Rafa coming back in. And ultimately, I suppose you don't support the owner, you support the club. But I'd imagine for a lot of Newcastle fans, there probably is a tricky period ahead just in terms of trying to balance that in your mind in terms of your support of the club.
Yeah, I mean, there is going to be Newcastle fans who won't really care where the money's coming from. They're just happy to see the back of Mike Ashley. And, you know, the fact that they're getting linked to the likes of Pochettino or of talk of Rafa Benitez coming back. You know, we do see certain players being linked with them as well. Felipe Coutinho was a player linked with them during the week. So they're going to be excited by the prospect of that. Then, you know, you're going to get the fans that are thinking, oh, this would not be good for basically a state to own our club. But, you know, there's going to be people that can, on both sides of the argument, where they can say, I want to support my club, but I don't support the owners either. So, you know, it's a tricky one.
Well, I'd imagine most of you have been watching The Last Dance over this week and over the last couple of weeks as well. The first four episodes are on. It has inspired our next talking point here on the Paddy Power Half Hour. Have a listen to this. This is Gary Payton speaking about Dennis Rodman on the third episode of the series.
Dennis Rodman was the fuck-up person. He just fucks everything up. He's a pest, shutting down whoever he wanted to. It was always a challenge. He was one of them players that had changed the game just by his presence.
So, Endicott, who are your players on the really good teams who were able to mess it up for the opposition, a bit like Dennis Rodman when he was playing for Detroit and playing for Chicago? Who does it for you in football?
There are many, many names. And before we came on here, I was actually I was looking back at the UEFA Cup final in 2003, because John Hartson was on talking to us on Wednesday night about his Champions League memories with Celtic, and that game inevitably came up. One of the players, he's a rare player that was actually brilliant on the ball, a really good player, but an absolute arsehole when it came to like niggling tackles, diving around, time wasting, and that's Deco. Deco was he was a brilliant, brilliant player for Barcelona and for Porto as well. And he might not have hit the heights that he had in Spain when he moved to England, but he was such a time waster, such a diver. A great player for, and we'll talk about a couple of players that kind of fit this bill as well. Sergio Busquets would be one. Great player for putting in a really bad challenge, but if somebody were to blow on him, would be down holding his face and time wasting. But Deco's my first man anyway that springs to mind.
Yeah, one thing Busquets is really good at doing as well is when he makes one of those tackles to take someone down, he's good at pretending he has been injured in the tackle himself as opposed to him sticking the studs into somebody. Definitely one of those spoilers in the team. Who's the ultimate spoiler for you, Phil?
See, there's two types here. There's the kind of tough tackler who is the no-nonsense tackler. So I think back to the 88 Cup final when Vinnie Jones went in on Steve McMahon. And that was almost like a statement. But it was just two hard men going toe-to-toe, and Steve McMahon would have got up straight away. And actually, when they met after that in Anfield a few seasons later, McMahon got a bite back at him, but Vinnie Jones just got up as if to say, yeah, you got me, grand. So they're those kind of players where they can put in reducers, but then you get the players that roll around. I think of Pepe. It's a Portuguese team here. Well, I know they're Brazilian born, but where, yeah, they like giving it out, but dishing it out. But as soon as anything happens to them, they're rolling around on the ground. And I just find it so frustrating. And you'd be embarrassed, especially when you see an action replay of it. You just think, how would those lads look at that and not be embarrassed by it?
Yeah, it's that kind of combination of steel and silk that you get into a side. And we're keeping the kind of Portuguese team going. I think if we were going to pick a manager for a team here, I'm guessing Jose Mourinho is the ultimate manager for this, where he'll go out and sacrifice football in order to get the result. You already spoke about that UEFA Cup final.
Yeah, like that UEFA Cup final is the prime example. Celtic fans to this day still are raging at the fact at some of the actions of the Porto players in that game. It was ridiculous to watch at times. And if you think back to the likes of the Inter Milan game against Barcelona, where they just parked a bus and that was all they had to do. He's a manager that didn't really care what people thought of him. I think he's kind of lost that a little bit, but at the end of the day, they're winners. And a lot of these players that we'll mention, and Dennis Rodman was a winner as well. These are things that they see as necessary to win, and you need those players in the team. If you only had classic players, if you didn't have the likes of the Busquets who are putting in those tackles. Gennaro Gattuso is another man that springs to mind from that great AC Milan team. Graeme Souness from that Liverpool team in the 80s. Sergio Ramos, if he wasn't willing for people to hate him after that Liverpool game, after fouling Salah, then Real Madrid may not have won that Champions League, and Sergio Ramos may not have been as successful as he has been. So these players are really, really important when it comes to top class winning sides, and Jose Mourinho is no different. He's a winner, and he was willing to do whatever it took to win. And that, at the end of the day, you have to admire that a little bit. If you don't like it, that's fair enough. Some people don't, but there's a little bit of entertainment in it as well.
Phil, I want to suggest another manager here, because his teams over the last decade have been absolutely determined in the big games to spoil things for the opposition. That's Diego Simeone and Atletico Madrid. And I guess one player we could probably take that's been quintessential in two different spells of the club for doing it as well would be Diego Costa. I think both are pretty worthy of mentions here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know Simeone and the tactics that Atletico Madrid would have used at Anfield when they dumped Liverpool out of the Champions League last month, in pretty much the last game of football we saw for that's kind of up until now. And yeah, they had their tactics. That you think back to even the first leg, what happened at halftime? Sadio Mane had to come off at halftime because, and some people weren't happy with Klopp. They said he shouldn't have done that because it's up to Mane to be responsible. But Mane could have just gone about his business. And it just sometimes a group of players are determined to get somebody sent off. Simeone himself did it to David Beckham at the 98 World Cup. In terms of Diego Costa, think back to an Arsenal game a few seasons ago when he got Gabriel sent off. He just at him for the whole game at And he obviously did something to Koscielny, and then Gabriel lashed out. He got sent off. And I remember actually Damon Delaney, obviously a regular on off the ball, marked Costa in a game for Palace at Stamford Bridge. And he said he loved it because here was Costa trying to wind him up. He said, to be honest, didn't really know what he was saying, but I loved the physicality of it. Whereas Costa doesn't want you to like that. He wants you to be put off. And if you don't engage in that kind of thing with him, then eventually he'll disappear. But yeah, he's definitely got to be in the team. In terms of a goalkeeper, I think back to his name escapes me, and I'm sure there's plenty of people screaming now where they'll know his name, the Israeli keeper.
Oh, against Ireland, who went down a million times and held his ribs and held his shoulder and killed about 15 minutes of that qualifier.
Yeah, like Brian Carroll will remember his name, but I remember just being at that game that day and just the frustration of it. And that's what these players do. They spoil things. They make sure that they bite. They waste a bit of time, and it just really winds you up and it gets you angry. What happens when you get angry? Sometimes you get out of the flow of what you're actually meant to do on the pitch, and that's why they're spoilers.
And when it comes to these guys, I guess it's okay to kind of like them as well. I know Kevin Kilbane has many times stated Diego Costa is one of his favourite players, and the reason why is because he's got that bit of bite, he's got the winner mentality about him. We are kind of drawn to these players as well. We love to hate them, don't we?
Well, I love these players. I think they're as important as your stylish players who can spray the ball over and back the pitch. I return to the fact that a lot of these players that we'll name are winners. Diego Costa is a winner. And if you look at every great team over the last couple of years, and even I'll reference this Liverpool team, it's something that's come into Andy Robertson's game a little bit as well. He has a little bit of bite about him. He's squaring up to people. He's putting in nasty little tackles, little cheeky kickouts after the ball's gone dead when the ref's not looking, and that's great. It's not a bad thing. It's a great thing to have because you can see players reacting, and he's loving it. He just runs off with a big smile on his face, and that's what you need. And it's a killer instinct. That's all it is. And I personally love these players. Diego Costa is one of my favorite to watch. It's just funny to watch players get so angry at such a little thing, like Diego Costa is just standing on your toes or something like that there, and It's funny to watch. It's really entertaining, and that's why we watch football.
We've mentioned two managers and a dozen players now at this stage. As we finish up for today, I'll give you an option to have one of these players each. End a call. If your club could have any of these villains that we've just mentioned, who would you pick?
Oh, God. Diego Simeone.
We haven't even mentioned Suarez.
Yeah,
we haven't
mentioned.
There's a couple of names as well that I have that I haven't mentioned. I mean, you're the likes of Roy Keane he's one of those guys that's not afraid to do it.
I think he falls into that other category because
the hard man category.
Yeah, but like Roy Keane is a quality player. So there's certain players that just never. A lot of these players we've mentioned are quality players, but Keane was one that he put in the tackle, and if someone put in the tackle on him, he'd get up and just get on with it.
Yeah. So I would go with Sergio Ramos as my defender. My manager would be Diego Simeone. And if you allow me to choose one more, you have to put Diego Costa into that team.
Okay, real kind of Latin flavour about the picks that Enda has there. Phil, who are you taking?
Well, see, Suarez will do whatever it takes to win. And like the World Cup, Uruguay, Ghana is your prime example. That's what he was doing. Then you see the other side of him where he gets stuck into players with his teeth. That's obviously not a nice thing. When he did that for Uruguay against Ghana, you can imagine if you were from Ghana, like we think back to our experience with Thierry Henry, we were livid. This was at the actual World Cup that we had missed out on.
And he was far more blatant. Like Henry can always make the argument that the ball rolled onto his arm. He controlled it that way and he passed it across to Gallas. In the case of Luis Suarez, this was premeditated. He decided, I'm diving with my hands.
This was like, I need to take the chance because otherwise we're going out of the World Cup. And obviously, Asamoah Gyan then misses the resulting penalty. Uruguay end up winning the game and they go through. So he was vindicated for it. But yeah, it's... that's the one thing where I thought, you know what, if he was on your team and he did it, you'd be thinking, what a legend.
Yeah. So we're going pretty much the league across the board. I'm going to take Busquets as my player to have as a spoiler within the team. Phil Egan, you're happy enough to take Luis Suarez?
For that incident itself, but for the biting, I can't condone any of that, though.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
And, or the racism.
And then in classic style, you took about four people and a manager while you were selecting your who is the number one, though, Enda, so we can at least have that?
Right, number one, it has to be Sergio Ramos.
Okay, La Liga is the place to watch for this kind of S-housery then, if you want to watch them. Phil Egan and Endicall, thanks a million for joining me on the Paddy Power Half Hour this Friday afternoon. All of our football coverage here and Off the Ball with thanks to Paddy Power. If you want to listen back to the show, you can catch us in the podcast section for your audio needs. And if you want to watch us back, however you want to do that, you can go on to Off the Ball's social channels on Twitter, Facebook, and also on YouTube as well. And thanks a million for you for listening into us this afternoon, and have yourself a very good long weekend.
The Paddy Power Half Hour on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.
That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.